From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's at stake as the United States Supreme Court considers a Republican challenge to the Affordable Care Act?
You know, there's much that hangs in the balance in terms of the future of healthcare in this country, so it's really a critical case.
Also, how the auto industry fared in a year when fewer drivers were actually hitting the road.
This industry is powered out of this pandemic and negotiated it much better than I think a lot of people thought. They took out a lot of debt to get through it, and they've already paid back big chunks of it.
And the election that saw a historic voter turnout.
The American people really voted in large numbers, and I think the increase in turnout was expected. But I think that this turnout is reflective of the current times that we're in.
What does the demographic breakdown of Trump and Biden voters tell us about a shifting Michigan political landscape? All those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to drill down on early election results to see what experienced poll watchers learned about Michigan voters and about polling.
Voters were also worried about issues, either, you know, on the Republican side, how the issues frame around crime and law and order, on the Democratic side, about issues of racial justice.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, the United States Supreme Court today hears oral arguments on key pieces of the Affordable Care Act. The Obama-era healthcare plan is being challenged by Republican state attorneys general. What hangs in the balance is whether insurance companies will any longer be required to cover pre-existing conditions. So what might that mean for programs that have been successful at the state level, such as the expansion of Medicaid in Michigan? Marion Udow Phillips is a lecturer at the University of Michigan School of Public Health and the Ford Policy School. She's also director of the Center for Health and Research Transformation. Marion, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Great to be here today.
So what are you paying attention to with today's hearings?
Well, certainly I've been following the oral arguments and looking to see what kinds of questions the justices are asking the attorneys on this case. And of course, you know, there's much that hangs in the balance in terms of the future of healthcare in this country. So it's really a critical case.
Can you give us a bit of a preview? And I know you're taking time away from your data and your monitoring to tell us this, but what arguments would you expect the Republican attorneys general to post to the court today?
Well, the Republican attorneys general have generally been arguing that because the court in 2012 found that the Affordable Care Act was constitutional based on its taxing power, and because the penalty, which is effectively the tax, was eliminated, that the entire law is no longer constitutional. That has been the foundation of their argument. And I think that will be continuing the foundation of the argument today, although I think they're also going to be arguing, and I think they've also been asked about the standing and how the states who are challenging this law, what their harm is. So I think it's going to be on those central issues around this case.
Tell us about your concerns if this aspect of the ACA is struck down.
Well, of course, the law is interwoven into everything that we experience these days in healthcare, right? It's not just about individuals and the tax that they had to pay previously to get coverage if they didn't get coverage on the individual exchange. It's also about coverage under Medicaid. It's also about how healthcare is financed and delivered and all of the experiments that have gone on with regard to accountable care organizations and the organization of delivery. And it's also in things like the calorie counts that we see in restaurants. That's all fundamental to elements of the Affordable Care Act. So much of it is interwoven in our healthcare system under this law. If the entire law was struck down, it would have a very significant impact on how we all get our health care.
There's been a great deal of public debate about the conservative swing in the court's composition during the Trump presidency. Do you think that it's a foregone conclusion how the Supreme Court will rule on this case?
Oh, I absolutely do not think it's a foregone conclusion. And I think it would be too much to read into the composition of the court to determine how they will rule in this case, because it's actually a fairly complex case. And even very conservative attorneys have been shocked, actually, that the case has made it this far. Many of them believe that it was a case without a lot of foundation to begin with. So I think And the questioning so far does seem to be really questioning this question of severability. And severability means that if one part of a law is determined not to be constitutional, does that really invalidate the entire law? So I don't think we can assume that conservative justices will rule that the law is unconstitutional.
The question of pre-existing conditions has been a part of public debate in any number of congressional and Senate races and the presidential debate as well. The president and Republican allies insist that Americans would still be protected even if the court strikes this down, but they haven't really outlined how. Can we just project if America finds itself in a place where the Supreme Court strikes down pre-existing conditions, what would the next steps be to try to restructure that? And what level of government would be tasked with doing it?
Right. That is a very complicated question. And if the law was struck down tomorrow, there would be no protection in most states from people being excluded from health coverage based upon pre-existing conditions. Interestingly, before the Affordable Care Act, some states, Michigan was one of them, had laws on the books that required some health plans to take patients, individuals for coverage regardless of their health status. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan, for example, in Michigan, was required to take all comers regardless of health status. However, that law was repealed when the Affordable Care Act went into effect because all health plans were then required to take patients regardless of their health status. It's called guaranteed issue, and all health plans had to do that. So if the law fails tomorrow, states and the federal government would have to put a complex series of laws in effect. It's not just mandating that that health plans can't exclude people. It has to go along with a whole series of rating reforms and other structures that were put in place in the Affordable Care Act to be companions to that provision of the law.
So, as I mentioned earlier, the expansion of Medicaid that happened in Michigan under Governor Rick Snyder would be at least in part imperiled by this if the ACA were overturned. Can you give us some detail about how it might be impacted by a Supreme Court decision?
Yes, absolutely. The entire Healthy Michigan plan was put in place under the Affordable Care Act, and the federal government provides the majority of funding for the Healthy Michigan plan. 90% of the dollars that are now provided for Healthy Michigan come from the federal government. And that would be ended if the Affordable Care Act was determined to be unconstitutional. Today, we have more than 800,000 Michiganders who are covered under Healthy Michigan. So their coverage would be imperiled if this law were determined to be unconstitutional.
You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic now, and it seems wrong to discuss this without noting that one of the most popular parts of the ACA was the expanded health coverage it offers to young adults who can still stay under their parents' health plans until they're 26 years old. Would that provision disappear if the ACA is overturned?
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of the other provisions that is built into this law that did not exist before the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, all of these coverage protections that we're talking about are at risk if the law were determined to be unconstitutional.
We've heard from Republican lawmakers that despite the fact that some aspects of the ACA are quite popular, it's still not the best way forward. Congressman Peter Meyer, newly elected in Western Michigan, said as much on this show yesterday. Do you think there is a better way to make health care more accessible and more affordable? Should President-elect Biden find himself in a position where he needs to do that? And should he find Congress in a mood to have the conversation?
Well, you know, there are a lot of ways to make health coverage more accessible and more affordable for consumers. We have lots of examples around the world of how every developed country, except for the United States, has made health coverage a universal right, right? They've made it a social good. We don't really do that even under the Affordable Care Act in the US. So we know how to do it. The issue is that all of the ways where we can make healthcare more affordable involve things that many Americans don't like. It involves higher taxes, or it involves something that the Affordable Care Act included in its first version. It includes a mandate. Now, the Affordable Care Act did raise taxes for some, and it raised federal spending in many ways to make coverage more affordable. So there are a lot of ways to expand it. The question is the political will there to do so? Now, President-elect Biden has made explicit proposals on how to make coverage more affordable. He falls squarely in the camp of building on the Affordable Care Act. He's not on the end of the spectrum that talked about Medicare for all. But even his ways, where he would add a public option, he would expand the subsidies to make coverage more affordable for people who are at somewhat higher incomes than get subsidies and tax credits today, all of those would take support from Congress. And we don't know whether Congress is in a mood to make those changes. And of course, the Republican critiques of the Affordable Care Act they've not come forward with a plan on what they would replace it with. So we really haven't seen those ideas yet.
Not to say that the years of Barack Obama's presidency were among the most unified in terms of Congress and what was going on in the White House, but it really does feel like it was a different moment in time when the Affordable Care Act was passed. What do you see evolving right now, where we have a Democratic president-elect, Democrats in control of the House, although not on a huge margin, and for the moment, Republican control of the Senate? Is that the climate in which this debate could be repeated?
I would predict that we're not going to see those big debates on health care going forward in the climate that we're currently in. Instead, I think what we will see is actually a Biden administration focusing on the tools that they have on the regulatory side. So there were a number of changes, for example, that were made by the Trump administration that actually made it more difficult for people to get coverage. And we've seen a reduction in the percentage of our population, even before COVID, who had health insurance since the Trump administration took office. And we know pretty much why those things happened, what specific steps were taken that reduced insurance coverage in the Trump administration. So I think we'll see the Biden administration reverse those changes, try to do more outreach, get more people covered under the existing law. There might be some things that he could take to Congress. There seems to be support, for example, for ending things like surprise medical bills. I think there are ways that there could be some consensus from Congress, but I don't think we'll see those big changes that he proposed in his platform unless there's a change in Congress.
Marianne Udow Phillips is a lecturer with the University of Michigan School of Public Health and the Ford Policy School. Marianne, it's good to talk to you. Take care.
It's great to talk with you too, April. Take care of yourself.
In just a minute, what a new administration might mean for the future of the auto industry. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We got an announcement out of Ford today. The company plans to add 350 jobs at two U.S. factories, one of them in Michigan, to meet expected demand for electric vehicles. Now, these are all cars that have not actually gone on sale yet. The automaker says that 200 workers will be hired at Ford's Electric Vehicle Center in Dearborn. The other projects in Missouri. There's something of a bigger picture to be examined here. And with us to talk about this and some other automotive news is Daniel House, associate business editor at the Detroit News and a columnist. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
All right. So the Dearborn news possibly is a little smaller in comparison to the $100 million Ford is going to invest in Kansas City. But, I mean, on the merits, do you see this as something significant in the company's ongoing strategy to electrify?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're seeing with Ford and even more so with General Motors that electrification is real. And with this election, I think you're going to see more alignment between the incoming administration and the auto industry in terms of the direction they want to go on electrification. The Trump administration focused a lot on yesterday's technology. They were worried about rollbacks in fuel economy and trying to pull back from the Obama years. There's no question that I think Biden is much more focused on electrics. The problem is the market isn't necessarily there yet. What I think is significant about the Ford announcement today is look at the product that they're talking about here. It's a small transit van.
Mm-hmm.
It's a product that can be used by grocery stores and delivery services and things in various parts of the country, both urban and suburban applications. It's not necessarily going to be something that is owned by you and me, it's something that's going to be bought by business. And I think you're seeing that a lot with a lot of these startup companies also in the EV space. They're focusing some of their product on the business and commercial side of the market, not on the citizen side.
Yeah. I mean, since you mentioned Joe Biden, I saw a couple of news outlets this week. Looking at you, Wall Street Journal, making much of the fact that Joe Biden is a car guy. I mean, how deep is that? We know he's got a thing for Corvettes, but can you tell us something about his record as senator and former vice president in terms of policies that really affected auto companies and their staff?
Yeah, thank you. Liking a vintage Corvette does not qualify you as a car guy unless you're Jay Leno and you have, you know, however many dozens of them. He was a car guy. But having said that, the president-elect is someone who clearly has been friendly to labor unions, to the UAW. I think has made himself known to say, I'm going to be the most labor-friendly president you've seen maybe ever, but probably not ever, but certainly in a long time. He was, of course, vice president in the Obama administration when they made that difficult call in the first few months of the administration that they were going to begin a bailout process, first of Chrysler, that culminated in General Motors. These were federally induced bankruptcies that rescued both of those companies. Now, Chrysler did end up becoming controlled by the Italians and Fiat, is very soon going to be controlled by the French through the Italians. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that movie before in Auburn Hills. But nevertheless, yeah, the administration he was a part of did do the most audacious rescue the auto industry has ever seen. I don't think there's any question about it. And as I've said many, many times on this air and others, I believe that a Republican president, when faced with the same potential economic calamity in the electorally vital industrial Midwest, would have done exactly the same thing. Look at what's happened in this election. The reason Joe Biden is president-elect is because of Michigan, is because of Pennsylvania, is because of these other industrial states. So it's very critical. And he did play a role in the administration in doing that.
Biden said a couple times during the campaign he wants to bring as many auto jobs back to America as possible, right, fueled mm-hmm. primarily by an electrified future. It sounds in step with what the big three have been working on, but I mean, I'm just not sure like what's realistic to hope for in terms of the past grandeur that the industry had in this region.
Yeah, well, I think you can forget past grandeur. That train has, a proverbial train has left the station.
Okay.
I'm glad you brought this up because I think the president-elect has got a misunderstanding of what electrification of the auto industry actually is likely to mean. What it's more likely to mean is that there will be fewer jobs in production. As electric powertrains become more ubiquitous in the marketplace and in more segments of the market, that means that there's going to be fewer internal combustion engines that are purchased and or produced. ICEs, as they're called in the trade, use a lot more parts, demand a lot more parts, have a lot bigger supply base, and employ a lot more people to assemble those engines. They're becoming increasingly expensive. Electric vehicles and the price of batteries is coming down. And so ultimately, I think you're going to see a net diminution of employment in the industry because electric vehicles have fewer parts, they last longer, and as a result, the replacement rate is likely to decline.
Yeah.
And so when he talks about creating all these jobs, I know that there's a conversation going on in the industry as we speak saying there's a fundamental disconnect here between what you think is going to happen and what is actually trending.
Hmm. I mean, which is not to say it's a bad thing or something other than inevitable, but it's just what it is. Can we review Ford's market position in EVs and where it needs to go? I mean, it's just that company whose bread and butter has been large traditional vehicles for so long now.
Yeah, and those are going to continue. I think you got to give Ford credit for a couple things. One is that they are playing to their strengths, their brand strengths, whether it's Mustang and making a Mustang Mach-E EV. Mm-hmm. It's now bringing an electric powertrain into the F-Series pickup, the F-150, very critical. I think you're going to see more of that. GM, I think, is generally considered to be farther ahead in this. I think one of the interesting stories emerging out of GM right now is that they have got a new battery pack that they're going to be producing that they want to sell in the open market. So they essentially want to not only be an automaker, but be a supplier of a component. So essentially, they could be supplying these battery packs and potentially hydrogen fuel cells to startups, to other automakers who don't want to make the investment. They see that as a new revenue stream. Ford, I think, is much more tailored in what they're doing. They're focused on the e-transit that you asked about at the top is a good example. They're focused on the commercial side of the business. One of the things about the new CEO, Jim Farley, that I think is underappreciated, and my colleague Jordan Grzeleski did a really, really smart story on this right as he was becoming CEO, is his understanding that the commercial business, which is boring and delivery vans, and is really critical to the financial success of Ford. When he was running Europe a few years ago, they went from seventh in the marketplace to first in commercial vehicles. And it was all on the Transit, which we're just talking about here, which comes in kind of small, medium, and large and different kinds of sizes and everything like that. So they're focused more on those kinds of products and on their iconic products than they are in a bunch of new products. And GM, on the other hand, is developing a lot of new products. So it's more of a familiar versus a new strategy. And I think Ford is, at least now, is more on the familiar side, to taking vehicles that we all know what they are. We know what an F-150 is. But now we're going to offer it to you in a powertrain that can either be hybrid, gas electric, or pure electric. And I think their thinking is people will be more receptive of vehicles they know as opposed to something called the Cadillac Lyriq. What the hell is the Cadillac Lyriq? Yeah, what the hell is that? Okay, it's fine. I mean, it's an SUV-style kind of product, as I recall, but it's new. And, you know, GM is famous for throwing a lot of new names at people all the time, whereas how old is the BMW 3 Series? I mean, it's been around since you and I've been around,
right?
More or less. So there's familiarity. So I think that's one of the things. But in terms of volumes, I think GM is clearly ahead of the game. But right now, what I think you see is people really positioning for what's their competitive position, how do they stake it out, and I think you've got some interesting stories certainly in Detroit.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Daniel House, an associate business editor with the Detroit News. Yeah, we should say that the Ford investment in Dearborn kind of pales in comparison to the new Fiat Chrysler plant that was announced not long ago. I mean, maybe we should just pull back and look at this spurt of investments and transition that the manufacturers are working hard to try to stay online for. Do you see investors confident that the public is going to follow this lead if the kind of math that you're talking about in terms of the kind of vehicles pans out?
Well, I think the short answer is, if you look at the valuation of Tesla, the answer is that investors clearly do see the value. The valuation of Tesla is multiples of GM and Ford and FCA combined. I think the reason you don't see movement in the stocks of traditional auto companies is there is doubt among the investor class that they will be able to unhitch themselves from 100 years old technology and ultimately make the move into electrification. Now, I think this process, I know there are people who are probably listening who are going to say, I want my F-150 gas engine and I want to die in it, right? And I don't plan on dying for another 25 years. Well, okay. I think you're still going to have gas vehicles, maybe if not 25, but maybe 15 or 20. It's going to be a process. But to your question about valuation, I think the people who are viewed as being more unhitched from the ICE technology are the people where the value is going. So as General Motors is a good example, as it becomes more real to the investors that these guys are serious about electrification and an all-electric future, they've developed their own battery. There have been Ford executives that say, we can't afford to invest. We're going to need 100,000. You'd need to have 100,000 battery units a year. Right. But people would then say, well, if you think that the electric future is for real, you're going to need a hell of a lot more than 100,000 units. Mm-hmm. So I think GM has said, we see that future and we're making that investment. Ford's kind of saying, we're not so sure yet. And so I think you see that in the valuations.
Quarterly sales figures were out last week. I mean, things could have been horrendous in 2020 given the pandemic. But I mean, it looks as though the picture is different. Were there any numbers there that particularly surprised you?
I think the run rate of a return to the pre-pandemic sales levels, which you hear from General Motors, I think is a real indication, mm-hmm. point one. Point two, the margins in North America for GM and Ford and for FCA were mind-blowing, head-slapping. I mean, we're in the mid-teens in some cases. We haven't seen numbers like that like in forever. Now, we've been cautioned, and analysts have cautioned, that that may be an aberration and likely is an aberration. It's not going to be a run rate. I've already heard, had some conversations actually yesterday, the expectation that Ford's fourth quarter is not going to be like its third quarter. But I think General Motors has really negotiated its way through this. And a lot of this has to do with the product cycles. And, you know, a product cycle starts to unwind years prior to shows up in the marketplace, right? So GM happened to be lucky in the sense that they had some really high revenue and high profit product that was coming into the marketplace. The same thing for Ford, actually. They got a new F-150 that's now in production, and it's going to be coming out and hitting showrooms. It already is. And that's just going to help. The average transaction prices on those new products typically always go up. And with those products, the profits go up because they're a percentage pretty much of the sales. So, I mean, I think from an industry standpoint, we have to look at this and say that this industry is powered out of this pandemic and negotiated it much better than I think a lot of people thought. They took out a lot of debt to get through it, and they've already paid back big chunks of it already. Jeez. So, I mean, that shows you the cash generation that they have. And what people don't understand is when these companies have lowered their break-even point coming out of the bankruptcies, when they start to get into a thing where their financial gearing really picks up, their ability to make money is astonishing. And I think you're starting to see that. And the question is, where does that run rate settle? It's not going to be what it was in the third quarter, but where is it going to settle?
We've talked before about the fact that the UAW corruption scandal would, in another 2020, have been the story of the year. Mm-hmm. And since this all first started spooling out, we've had convictions of 15 people. Mm-hmm. Have you been following the union's developments to try to get its house in order?
Short answer is yes, but it's gone very quiet in recent weeks and months. As I think you've noticed, we haven't done much here there at the Detroit News on this story because basically it's in some negotiations. Or had been in negotiations. Now, the thing that I wrote about a few months ago, and I think we talked about, has now come to pass. Mm-hmm. And that is that the Republican incumbent appears to have lost this election, even though he doesn't want to acknowledge it. That means that on January 20th, there's going to be a Democrat in the White House, and there's going to be a new attorney general. So there's a very good chance that the U.S. attorney, in fact, I would say it's probably a near certainty that the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District in Detroit, Matthew Schneider, will be looking for a new job. So the question then becomes, what happens to the UAW? I think they had been kind of dragging their feet in the hopes that this is exactly what would happen, that we would get a new U.S. attorney and that the whole threat of the government taking over the union would recede and that they would say, okay, enough of you went to jail. Two former presidents have either been indicted or have pleaded guilty in the case of Gary Jones. And down the road we go. We got the bad apples out. Now, we don't need to oversee you, and down the road you go, mm-hmm. which I think is exactly what Rory Gamble and the current union leadership would love to see happen.
Daniel House is an associate business editor at the Detroit News and also a columnist. You can read him regularly. Daniel, thank you for your time.
You bet.
Northern Michigan is reliably Republican, bolstered by a record voter turnout this year. But voters didn't rally behind President Donald Trump quite like they did 4 years ago. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports.
3 weeks ago, John Roth was door knocking in Grand Traverse County. He was running for the state house and wanted to talk with voters about what he'd bring to Lansing. But the residents he approached often wanted to talk about the president, like this voter.
I voted in every election, and I predominantly voted Republican. And our current president does not find favor with me.
The man says this time he picked some Democrats on his absentee ballot. Roth says he often has to explain he's not like Trump.
You know, I don't try and run away from the president. I'm just trying to make people understand that this position, in particular that I'm running for, is local. Mm-hmm. has nothing to do with national politics.
It appears voters made the distinction. In Grand Traverse County, Roth won his race, and other Republicans won decisively. Donald Trump still won the county, but his lead was significantly smaller than the last election, even though he had just appeared the night before at a packed rally in Traverse City. Across northern Michigan, in counties like Otsego and Wexford, voters showed up in record numbers, supporting Republicans, but not always Donald Trump. One county in northern Michigan flipped blue. Leelanau County voted for Trump last election, but this year, Biden won by 5 points. Leelanau Democratic Party co-chair Bridget Hart says the county is less conservative than the rest of the region.
You know, we're more like purpley blue than red.
Hart says there was a sense in the community that people had had enough. A lot of Leelanau residents are retirees and didn't like how the president was handling the pandemic.
People were just discussing with the political environment in general, and I think they just wanted to see a change.
But that only extended to the presidential race. The majority of residents voted Republican down the ticket. Grand Traverse County Commissioner Betsy Cafia says another dynamic is at play in this election. She thinks that there were still many voters who came out for Trump and shifted the vote in favor of Republicans.
I think with any other presidential candidate at the top of the ticket, the 104th would be a Democratic district at this moment.
Even though Republicans clearly swept northern Michigan seats, Cafia is optimistic Democrats still have a chance down the road. She says she's watched the community become more liberal over the past decade.
I really see it takes patience. It's maddeningly slow progress, but it is measurable progress.
Though in the next election for the statehouse seat, a Democratic challenger will have a tougher race against an incumbent, John Roth, in Grand Traverse County. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Coming up, more detail on what happened this election among some key Michigan cohorts.
But it might be that really Trump did motivate a very substantial number of people who are not really plugged into the political process and who are not regular voters.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If there's one thing we can say about the 2020 election, it's that it was a very notable year for Michigan voters. What we wanted to know is where presidential and party lines shifted over the past 4 years. In 2016, Donald Trump pulled off what was then a surprise victory in Michigan because of several key demographics. So who changed their mind in 2020? Here to talk about the early election results and where we go from here are Mark Grubner with Practical Political Consulting, based in East Lansing, longtime observer of Michigan politics, and we should say he's also an Ingham County Commissioner, registered Democrat. Hey, Mark.
Howdy.
And also with us today, Angela Ocampo, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Michigan. Angela, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is your first blush takeaway from what happened last week? I just wondered, you know, what was your big reaction to who turned out and maybe who didn't? Angela, would you mind starting us out?
Sure. I mean, I think for me, the biggest reaction, and takeaway from last week's election and, you know, the results is that the American people really voted in large numbers. And I think the increase in turnout was expected. But I think that we, in many ways, have seen that this turnout is reflective of the current times that we're in. I think also a main takeaway for me is the impact of minority voters and voters of color in the state of Michigan, but also throughout the country.
Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing you're talking about the impact in Wayne counties. Any place else where you feel like that was a factor?
Yeah, I think this was also the case, I think, in Kent County and Wayne County as well. But I think we also have to think about voters of color, obviously Black voters, Latinx voters, but also Muslim and Arab American voters in the state.
Sure. Mark, how about you? What was the big impression election night made on you?
I was startled that things were so close in Michigan. It didn't feel that way to me that Trump and the Republicans were really that competitive. And obviously, they were quite competitive in Michigan and quite competitive nationally. One would have thought that running as bumbling a campaign as President Trump did, that he would have disqualified himself. Maybe 50 years ago, we would have seen a landslide in this kind of a situation. And instead, we saw really a very close election.
I'm sorry I'm not able to cite the source on this right now, but I remember seeing an article in the weeks right before election that Republican new voter registration was up quite a bit. What do we take away from that? What does it mean that Donald Trump is a turnout agent for Republicans as much as, if not more, than he'd ever been?
There was some question about whether that is a real phenomenon or not. I think we're going to have to wait until we have accurate data about who actually registered to vote late. We won't have that for several weeks when the state compiles it. The reason that it may have been a mirage is that there was a very hotly contested Democratic presidential primary back in March, and that had a tendency to accelerate voter registration on the Democratic side. So it may be that what we were really seeing was that the available pool of people who were not registered to vote was predominantly Republican, just as a sort of an artifact of the calendar. But it might be that really Trump did motivate a very substantial number of people who are not really plugged into the political process and who are not regular voters, who just don't really implement their opinions by voting. They implement their opinions in other ways. And it may be that there were so many of those that is a part of why the election ended up being so close, as I said.
Yeah. Now, a few counties flipped from blue to red, but really not very many. Angela, you noted that Kent County went through some change. Where are some other spots that Joe Biden did well that Hillary Clinton did not do so well back in 2016?
Yeah. So I think, you know, one important thing to notice is just to think about so many different counties in the state where, even though they will continue to be red, the margin of the difference, right, sort of the difference between Biden and Trump was more narrow, right? So a lot of these counties still went Republican. And these are, for example, some of the northern Michigan counties. We can think of like Grand Traverse County and Antrim County and some of these other larger northern counties that still went, you know, majority for the Republican for Trump, but the vote difference was more narrow, right? And it was more narrow this time around than last time. And it was more narrow again in the favor of Biden. And so, you know, I think it's sort of interesting to think, right, how so many of the maybe in places where we didn't expect some of this margin to become more narrow, where it did happen. And of course, we, again, you know, saw important changes in Kent County and in Wayne County and also Oakland County.
Mark, tell me about the counties that you were paying attention to where there was definitely some flipping.
Well, again, as Professor Ocampo said, I'm not attracted to the idea that a county that changes from just under 50% to just over 50% for one party is a particularly important county. What's important is the amount of movement, even if it stays underwater or if it was already above water. So for me, there were about three important trends all going on. And we saw most of these are continuations from the past. We saw that Biden greatly reduced Trump's newfound strength among working class whites. We saw that Biden continued to strengthen the Democratic position among highly educated and wealthier whites. And we saw a surprising deterioration of Biden's or of the Democratic strength among minority communities. Not a huge deterioration, but it was certainly nothing that we were looking toward. We saw that the Republican strength in Black and Hispanic and Arab communities in Michigan was several percentage points weaker than had been expected. So all these things come together and you end up with an electorate which moves Democratic by just 2 or 3 percentage points, which is, of course, changing from a tiny Republican lead to a small but significant Democratic advantage.
Angela, I wanted to talk to you about one of the points in which voters found themselves very divided. And it's not really surprising, but I guess the question is, what does it suggest about the future? There was some exit polling conducted in Michigan, I believe by the AP, that was quoted by the New York Times, in which voters were asked to talk about serious problems in American society and were asked, you know, the degree to which race is an issue. And there's just this huge divide between Republicans and Democrats. The results that I'm looking at show that 81% of Democrats in this one exit poll said that it is a most important issue, just 15% of Republicans. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, I think part of those results really stem from who are the voters that make up, you know, the majority of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, right? So in many ways, it makes sense that that number is quite low for Republicans, given that we know that the Republican base tends to be majority white, and we know that the Democratic base, it tends to be more majority. It includes a lot of people of color. I think, you know, sort of at the same time, I would, you know, sort of be wary of a lot of these exit polls, primarily because in many ways they do also tend to undersample minority voters, right? And even in the state of Michigan, they only include not even a few hundred, right? And so I guess in many ways it is really interesting, I think, reflective to think about where the disagreement obviously comes from, a different partisan understanding, but the partisan understanding is also sort of a racial understanding, right? That most Democrats do see this as a major issue, and it does contribute to, you know, it heightened polarization that we see on a lot of other different issues between Democrats and Republicans.
I wanted to change gears a little bit and talk about what the results tell you both about how people were feeling in Michigan. Mark, you noted that the Republicans definitely put up some ground game and had a decent showing this year, considering, even though they lost the presidency. What do you take away about the mood of voters from all that?
Well, we saw almost no ticket splitters in Michigan. Looking back at the last few decades, Michigan has a reputation nationally as being a state with a substantial number of people who split their tickets, who are in the middle of the spectrum and determine elections by moving from one party to the other. And we saw very, very little evidence that anybody is willing to discuss voting across party lines, that the electorate is really divided almost cleanly into Democrats and Republicans.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, can we say that when we have the example of Kent County, where the electorate went for Joe Biden for president, but also elected Peter Meyer, or also the fact that the Michigan House and Senate remain under Republican control, even though Biden got a win? Can we really say there's no ticket splitting?
Well, in the first place, Peter Meyer's district includes parts of two other counties which are more Republican and does not include all of Kent. I think that he may have, if he had been in all of Kent and included the rest of the county, I think he would have lost the county just as Trump did, because he was only running about 2 percentage points different in each precinct than the president was. So it's one of these situations where somebody wins or loses a county, but there isn't that much going on. The districts were drawn very carefully by the Republican legislature 10 years ago to make it so that the whatever Democratic strength there is in Kent County was divided between two districts, and so the rest of Kent goes into a Republican district to the west. But yes, I don't think that for any candidate on either ticket that they were able to run very far away from their ticket. In other words, you couldn't run 10 percentage points better than the Republicans did if you were a Republican candidate. You might run one or two. In the past, we've often seen people run 10 and 15 and even 20 percentage points from their tickets, because people might say, well, he's a Republican, but he really feels this way or that way about the issue I care about. There was very little of that this year.
Hmm. Angela, what's your takeaway on how voters were feeling this year?
I think voters were really just worried about the pandemic, right? Voters were worried about the state of the economy. I think voters were also worried about issues, either, you know, on the Republican side, how the issues frame around crime and law and order, on the Democratic side, about issues of racial justice. And I think these were some of the issues that were at the top of the mind of these voters and these voters, obviously, in the state. And I think in many ways, it is sort of interesting. I think, you know, at the same time, we really think about the way in which the pandemic has affected the state and how this, you know, I keep going back to it because oftentimes we kind of forget, right? Like, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. I think we've all been so obviously very consumed with the election and the election returns. But I think this really has overshadowed in many ways a lot of the other issues that could have been in people's minds. And I think that this is probably and was probably one of the main concerns of people in the state on both sides of the aisle.
You know, this brings me to another question. The shock in 2016 among many voters was about polls. They thought that Hillary Clinton was definitely going to beat Donald Trump. They thought that that was what the polls were showing them. And it turned out that polls were not quite and were not quite being used in the way that really helped people predict the outcome of the Electoral College. I'm wondering if either of you learned anything about polling results this year that you didn't know after 2016. Mark, do you have thoughts?
Well, I do a fair amount of polling. My firm we specialize in what no one will believe I really say this, but we specialize in inexpensive, really second-rate polling. We do very bad polling. We do everything wrong, and so we can turn it in for a price that startles people how cheap we are.
What exactly, could you unpack what bad polling means in this context?
Well, I don't mean that all polls are bad. I just mean that my firm does bad polls. We have very small sample sizes. We only call landlines. We only ask two or three or four questions. We cut every possible corner, and that allows us to deliver a finished poll as cheap as $500. So everybody else charges 10 or 20 or 50 times as much, and they do a much better job. So I'm speaking from the perspective of having just finished about 50 polls in the state. And so I learned quite a bit from our results. And one of the most important things I learned was Republicans were simply unwilling to answer polls. They didn't misrepresent their views, I don't think, but they simply declined to answer the poll. So all polls had a tendency to pick up supporters of Biden more easily than we could pick up supporters of Trump.
Angelo, did you pick up anything this election cycle about polling that you think would be useful going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that for me was really interesting is just how there is a heavy reliance on polls, right? But polls are only, they only allow us to get estimates, and they're estimates at best, right? They don't necessarily tell us the sort of the true support for either candidate. They're going to be an approximation. They're never going to be sort of the true value. Even though we might try to reach out to people, right, on both Democrats and Republicans, if you don't have a response, right, then there's going to be a limited sort of representation of a particular group or demographic in a poll. And I think it's sort of interesting what was said earlier about thinking about it's harder to get Republicans on the phone, right? And so I think after 2016, there was a sort of a conversation as to and questioning as to whether or not it was sort of the shy Trump supporter that was maybe a result for why the polls really missed in trying to give us a clearer picture in 2016. But we find that that necessarily wasn't the case. And one of the major issues was that it wasn't that we're being shy about their support for Trump, but it was that a particular demographic, which were white, low education voters, were underweighted in many of the samples, right? And so, you know, this obviously can happen in the weighting procedure, but it also can happen when people are not answering the phones, right? So you're not even capturing them to begin with in your polls. And so I think it will be interesting moving forward to see like which particular demographic was not necessarily kind of quite well captured in the polls, right? Like which intersection of these demographics and sort of how this might give us a better picture as to, you know, we actually may need to do more of a blended sample between landlines and cell phones and online, right? I think thinking about the format and the mode, right? We're not necessarily capturing anymore, right? We're not doing a lot of these probability-based polls anymore. And we're relying a lot on these sort of online convenient panels. So this really skews the results and sort of skews, and it gives us a different type of data. So I think a lot of pollsters and a lot of political scientists are going to be really thinking about, you know, the kind of data that we're actually capturing in the months to come.
Angela Ocampo is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Michigan. We've also been talking with Mark Grebner of Practical Political Consulting. He's also an Ingham County Commissioner. Mark, Angela, thank you so much for sharing some thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show's producers include Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening along with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.